This first session, Enneagram and some definitions from the grief process, and get into how we deny a loss. So that's the theme around which we will work today. I don't know if you need any more background information than that. This is usually a full weekend workshop that we're going to try to do in these brief one-hour sessions. So I'll be talking fast and hope you can listen fast. Please stop me at any point. I hope to get some interaction going also.
Well, right away, I want to ask. I mean, a loss, do we deny it, really?
Yes, we do. People pass away, they don't die. We get furloughed, we don't get fired. Yeah, you've heard some of those terms?
Well,
there's a sense of a denial about it, and we'll go through parts of that. But yeah, it is. It's like, I got married. I lost my single state. There's a loss around that. A child is born, and there's a loss immediately. So that we keep looking at what loss is. So yeah, we do deny it. We're not aware that we do. And so much of what we're doing is pulling this to consciousness. Let me start, first of all, with the term Enneagram, and it's just pronounced A and Y, Enneagram. It's a Greek word that simply means 9 points. There are 9 equidistant points. I did not try to make them equidistant. This is the design. Fred's got the overhead next door. But they're equidistant points on a circle. You know, there's no beginning, no end on a circle. So there's no better, worse spot to be. There are 9 personalities in the Enneagram. It's an ancient philosophy combined with modern psychology. The theory itself, as a body of knowledge, has been taught in the United States only for about the last 30 years. It just recently then came into a full body of knowledge. It had been taught before by gurus who would deal with one individual to help them identify their basic unconscious motivation, which differentiated their personality from others. You, as well as I, have said, you know, why do they think that way? Why can't they see that this is so clear? You know, whatever it is we're talking about, I'm sure you've heard that. Or you've had people say, why don't they use their head? Or they never think about anybody but themselves. So we do have different personalities, and we're aware of that. We deal with it as 9 personalities, and just very briefly, we have head, heart, and gut centers. We tend to overuse one and underuse one. The other one is not necessarily balanced either. It's a supporter center. But some of us deal from the head. People are always thinking, coming up with new ideas, analyzing, all those things. Other people are relational and immediately get into eye contact with you, want to know who you are, want to know all about you, and want to be in some relationship. Just that simple. You can tell by walking into a room. Some people need immediately to connect with one individual. They need to be in a relationship so that they can feel comfortable coming to that room. Some people are doers. They don't necessarily think or feel, it appears. Example, real brief. If a wild cougar came into this room right now, the people who operate, first of all, from the head would be sitting here thinking, that is a wild animal. Now, oh my, isn't this interesting? Now, how did this wild animal get in here? And I wonder if we should do anything about it. What if we went out that door? Well, you know what's going to happen to those folks. The heart-centered people are going to say, that's a wild animal. I better be sure all these people get out safely. You hear the different emphasis? And you know what happens to the gut-centered people? We're long gone and grateful for the head people sitting here wondering what's going on. We all have those 3 centers in each of us. We have that capacity to think, to feel, and to survive. It's that gut part of us that helps us survive. Now, the gut part of us is gone, huh? Hopefully at that point, that's what's driving us. But if we don't use the gut well, that may not be survival. You may have just fed the cougar. So, but each of us operates primarily from one of those three centers. And those of you who were in some of Fred's sessions last week have a little more background than that. But that's as much as I can give you at this point. We'll be getting more as we can go through the session. But know that there are nine personalities and there are three centers. As I'm talking, I'm conscious that there are nine different ways I'm being heard. And frequently, there are nine different ways I'm being quoted. And I'm thinking, ooh, I wonder if I really said that. So that everything we do and are is filtered through our primary center. And what we're trying to do is see if we can balance the three and use each of them appropriately. If you ever succeed in that, let me know how. It's not that easy because it's unconscious motivation. And what we try to do is pull it to consciousness so we have some choices. If I'm on automatic pilot, I don't have any choice, do I? It's already set and we know where we're headed, or somebody knows where we're headed. But if I'm driving my own vehicle, then I have to know where I'm headed, and somebody's in charge then. And that's kind of the way it is with life. As we look at grief and loss issues, let's think for just a second, quickly, about different kinds of loss. First of all, we have what are called obvious losses. What would some of those be?
Death of a relative.
Death of a relative. Pardon?
Car keys.
That can cause us some grief, can't it? And maybe somebody else. What are some more obvious losses?
Job.
Loss of a job.
Divorce.
Although we can put that in another category, which we will in a minute.
Loss of, like, hair.
Loss of hair.
Youth.
Physical ability. I know I was rear-ended twice in 20 months. And it was real obvious. There were some immediate losses, including job, mobility, and a few other kinds of things that entered into there, kind of flowed from that. What would be some not-so-obvious losses?
Well, the one that you mentioned earlier about the birth of a... I never thought of getting married or giving birth to a child as a loss. I wasn't.
For one person it is, yeah. And for another one it isn't. For the mother, it's a gain. For the child, it's a loss. It's a loss of security. Yeah.
And for the mother, it's also a loss because it could be called a loss of independence.
That's right. It loses a whole lot real fast, not for a long time, like for life. I also want to bring this to your attention, the book Necessary Losses by Judith Viorst. And the first one she mentions is birth. If we don't go through that one, then nothing else comes along, including life. And so it's one of those, from loss can come life possibility too. So the not so obvious ones could be aging. You know, when I'm trying to walk up that hill yesterday, it's like 60 is very different from 30. Very different. You mentioned loss of hair. What else?
Eyesight.
Mm-hmm. Some of us lost it very early. Mm-hmm. Hearing. All those kinds of, some of the aging kinds of things. Serious illness can be not so obvious loss. A heart attack, boom. You don't think of that immediately as loss, but then you start putting in there, what have you lost as a result of that? You know,
stroke,
all kinds of those not so obvious ones, huh? There are then what are called limbo losses. Limbo losses, neither here nor there, or could be either one. What would that be?
Moving?
All right. The excitement of a new place, but losing familiarity. Somebody mentioned divorce a while ago. That one could also fit in here.
Leaving Holden.
That's right. And some people are looking at that now.
I once read that every choice is a loss.
That's true. When we move forward, we're leaving behind all kinds of other choices. That's true. Another one could be retirement. Selling a house. Kind of the major stress points in life, have a brother who just 2 months ago remarried. She quit her job, he retired, they sold the house, moved into fifth wheel, and got married within 10 days. And she said to me, he has been alcohol-free for 22 years, and she has just celebrated 16. And she said, I haven't been under so much stress since I quit drinking. But both of them are aware that that's what's happening, and that's what they're choosing, and therefore it's going to be okay. But that's a lot in a short time. And so they had to go through that process of grieving each one of those losses. Sometimes we can do it ahead of time. Sometimes. And sometimes we aren't aware. We think we did it ahead of time, but we didn't do that. But in terms of the necessary losses, as Judith Viorst talks about, we have to be aware that what we give, that a loss is what we give up in order to grow. The loss of leaving high school or college. There's an excitement about moving on, but at the same time, we've got to look at what are we losing. So let's look at some of the definitions around loss. There are many terms. People use bereavement, grief, mourning, kind of almost interchangeably, and yet they're each a piece of the whole pattern. Bereavement is a state caused by the loss. It's a state. It's our whole mental, emotional, and physical being that changes and is caught up in the loss. We might be on a different eating pattern, a different sleeping pattern. Would affect our physical well-being, wouldn't it? We begin to forget things, get distracted, it's too hard to focus, which would be affecting our head center, huh? And our heart center is caught up with a realm of emotions that we can't predict, we don't seem to be able to control. And so, we're kind of upset with ourselves and with other people. And so it affects our whole being. So it's that state of being in that grieving process. And grief is a process, it's not an event. It's the whole process. Grief counselors say that grief is a two-year process. The hard part is we don't know when it starts. It may start years after the event. Sometimes it starts before. A person with a terminal illness, a close friend of ours, a member of the family, we begin to grieve before the person dies, don't we? It's anticipatory grief. So it begins earlier than the actual event, but it's still a process. It's still a process that has to take there. Grief is kind of waking up in the middle of the night and realizing that the person who's usually there in that bed isn't there anymore. It's having an experience and thinking, I've got to tell, and realizing they're not there. Reaching for the phone and can't connect. All of that is part of the grief. It's hearing that special song, visiting that special place, walking into that room. It's all those little things that kind of jar us, and when we least expect it. But sometimes we can prepare ourselves, and other times it's like, whoa, I thought I was finished with that, and I'm not. And I'm not. And that's that process. It comes up when you least expect it. The emotions well up. The whole process of eating, sleeping, routine kind of things gets disrupted. We think we're on the way, and boom, we're right back. So it feels like we haven't gone anyplace. We're not farther on the way, and yet we probably are. We probably are, especially if we can become aware of what's happening and be okay with it. We are who we are as we are. And we have to work through it. We have then that anticipatory grief, but we also have acute grief. The acute grief is what happens at the point of the loss. The very, very intense emotions immediately after the loss. And then mourning is a process also that results from that whole experience. Mourning is remembering. Grief is not something to be gotten over. But when we talk about grief in terms of death, it's not something to be gotten over, but it's just a reminder that we've loved. And love is hard work, living or dying. So we just need to know about that. Any questions? Does that, some of that make sense in your life? What I'd like you to do as we move through here is have in your memory a particular loss, a particular event, perhaps one that isn't quite immediate if you've suffered one very, very recently, but one that you've, you know, that you feel like, yeah, you've gone through that and come out the other side. It'll be more helpful to move through the process. If you're in that acute grief right now, then perhaps that needs to kind of be just set aside for a minute, and let's move through it, and it might help you in the acute grief. So think of a particular event that, you know, that a loss that you want to deal with. One that has been sort of recent, but not really raw still. And this is what we're doing here, only the first stage right now. There are different stages of loss. This first stage is called shock and numbness. When you have heard on Friday afternoon that as of Monday you have no job, what's your reaction? When you've gotten word that someone has just died, expected or unexpected, it's always a shock. As I talk through these points, see if you can identify yourself. And I might ask here, I know some of you were in the introduction to the Enneagram last week. How many here got some of that information last week? Enough to know your number? Or what I think? Maybe this is one of the personality that I am? It's helpful, it is not essential. It's helpful. Because I am, as you see, focusing or looking at nine different ways. And let me just talk through it here briefly and quickly. The personality that I'm identifying here as number one is an inspector. The inspector personality is someone who focuses in and knows how to make it better. Just instinctively knows how to make it better. They're looking for quality control. Now, they operate out of the gut center, which is survival. But they go into what we call a neutral external, stunned kind of sense. And this personality does a lot of shoulds and oughts. You should, you ought, you should do this, I should do this. And so you hear shoulds and oughts a lot. And this person internally says, what should I do? What should I do? But it's a neutral external, nothing, not much shows on the outside, even though they're an action-oriented person. Not much shows, and there's just that stunned, I don't know how to proceed. What should I do? The assistant two, who is usually about helping other people, wanting to do for others, goes into an active external, hysterical. What about me? How dare you die and leave me alone? How am I going to make a living if I don't have a job? What about me? And it's an active, external, hysterical. And you might, you know, keep thinking about your own response in your issues of loss. The administrator three is usually the person who has their eye on the goal and they know how to accomplish it. Long-term kind of vision. And they go to an active, external and pretend, saying, what was that again? It's as though, you know, how could this be? My goal is out there and you just disrupted it. What was that again? Pretend that nothing has happened in a sense. But get very busy out here. How can that be? The author four is a more reflective person. And they go into a passive, internal, overloaded mode, and very often their exact words are, oh my God, incomprehension, shock and numbness, real clearly. Oh my God. An awesome, almost a prayer-like, help, help. It's a passive internal, overloaded emotionally. The Sage Five, who generally operates from the head, or in the head center, goes into an active internal analytical. I don't understand. And I need to understand in order to move on, says the Sage Five. I don't understand. And I'm sure you have experienced with yourself or other people some of these similar reactions. The Facilitator Six, and I'm using facilitator, these are the gifts that people have, goes into an active, external, shows on the outside, procedural. Now what? These are the ones who would organize the people to get the life raft off of the ship and get people into them. Active, external, procedural. What now? They're the ones who move into action. Just an automatic response. The Seven, the optimist, usually very joyful, happy, enthusiastic, goes into an active, external, distracted emotionally that says, let's go. Let's go for a walk, let's go get an ice cream cone, let's go. We can't just sit here trying to absorb this. Into action, let's go. Do something. You can't just sit here and feel this because it's too hard emotionally. The Champion Eight also goes into an active external, but a disengaged. Just keep going. It's like the ever-rated battery. It keeps going and going and going, and perhaps nothing makes sense. But the gut is still in motion. The gut is survival, and so it just keeps doing routine things. These are the people who would go into cleaning the house, vacuuming 29 more times. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't need to. But they need to keep busy. They need to keep going. The Negotiator Nine, who is usually a very passive person, passive, peaceful, keep things on an even keel, does exactly that. They go into a passive internal and external as though they are paralyzed. And their response is, what? Apparently no reaction. No reaction. What? Almost a paralysis kind of response. Does that fit you? Any one of them? Or all of them? It's like, ooh, we can all look at that. Yes?
Are there any of these that are more helpful than others in terms of working through the
crisis?
Yeah.
In at the moment of crisis?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm thinking also sort of that the grieving is a process, as you said, in mourning. I mean, is there any of these that is sort of, just because some of them are more emotional at the time, is that helpful then in the long term?
Well, in the long term, I think, you know, and as I say, this is stage one.
Okay.
In the long term, we've got to pull back and use our head and our heart and our gut. We've got to, you know, that initial reaction is unconscious response. It's kind of like something makes me angry and I'm angry. The choice now is, what do I do with the anger? And that's kind of here too. It's the initial reaction is unconscious. And then I can begin to say, now what? What do I do with this? How do I transform this? In the long term, I don't know that any one is any better than another. It's just, this is how we do react. And if we find ourselves here, then I think it's helpful for you to hang on to where that number is, for those of you who don't know the Enneagram, because I think you'll find that it falls right on through the process. because we'll have a different handout for the different stages. What is your experience? What's your experience in your own loss?
The six continues to fit me.
And it just keeps on going, huh? Mm-hmm. What now, huh? And you're the person probably who can know what needs to be done. We need to call these people, we need to alert this person, we need to do this, we need to do that, we need to move
sometimes
in action.
Sometimes I feel guilty because I'm not as hysterical or shocked about it
right.
as other people in the room.
And yet, we all respond differently. That's right. So that your head immediately goes into the checklist. Mm-hmm. Who should I call? What should I call the airplane to get a ticket?
And how is that different from the one? Because I was trying to decide whether I'm a one or a two. And this definitely, my reactions fit the one. What should I do? I just immediately, as soon as I hear something, it's like, okay, I can call this person and I can do it. Now, how's that different from the six?
That's immediately into the gut. How's it different from the six? For the one, it's more of a neutral external, and it takes, and each of these stages is a different timing for each of us. That could be instantaneous. What should I do is a different question than what now. The head's what now question says, okay, what do I need to do? The one's question is, what should I do first? It's a discernment question. Rather than a procedural.
And do they act upon it? Do ones act if they?
They do if they are able to get it together. But again, it's probably will act upon it because they are gut-centered. And that's the being-doing center. Mm-hmm. The head, I mean, we don't do different things. I need to emphasize that too, but we do them for different reasons. And that's what we're looking at. We do them for different reasons. We're all going to do what needs to be done. I happen to fit into the eight category. And I know 2 years ago, I was in a very intensive two-week seminar. And in the middle of that, got word that a friend was dying. And so I needed to take 48 hours in there and go visit a friend. I know that when I came back, I was conscious saying, I know that memory is stored in the gut, so if I just keep listening and keep attending the seminar sessions, when I need that information, it'll come back. Focus was gone. There was no way I could focus. The heart was all over the place. The emotions were everywhere you want them to be. Crying at the drop of a hat for apparently no reason. Those are all part of who we are. But my gut part of me said, just keep going. Just keep doing what you're doing, and it'll all come out okay. And it worked. You know, it happened. And it was not a conscious, you know, just keep going. It was just one step at a time. You can do it. But then there was that point of, I can't concentrate. There's no sense in sitting here. I'm just wasting time. But then it can come to the consciousness and say, just be okay with it. Be easy with it. Be as it is, and just keep going. For the most part, though, it's disengaged, totally emotionally disengaged. Just sit here and listen to the lecture and see what happens. When I need it, it'll come back, and yes, it did. I can trust that. And that's part of the stunned, that's part of the pretending, that's part of all these other pieces, but it's slightly different focus on it.
Mm-hmm. Can it make a difference if it's, you know, depending on the severity of the shock?
Sure.
Because I can think of myself as being a number six. You know, if it's almost like if it's a real severe shock, it's sort of like I go blank.
Uh-huh.
You know, or you know, keep doing what's the next thing to do. But if it's sort of a surprise, like you were talking about with your friend, then I could really see myself as a number two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about me?
Yeah.
At some point, I think all of this comes in. But it's like the initial shock, the very, very initial shock. And it could be just but it's like initially what happens, and then we can move on. For some of us, this stage is longer. For some of us, it's just almost in passing. And we stay in different parts of these different stages for differing amounts of time. This one is usually fairly short. Now, there are people who go into, physically, go into shock. And that's a whole other issue, because that's really severe. And other people then need to rescue, huh? Other people need to be alert to that. But for ourselves, this is frequently a relationship, shock of an announcement of a divorce, or shock of any kind of time. It may be very, very brief, and frequently is. But then it also can come back later, and almost back into that same shock again, because there aren't clear lines. You can't say, okay, I can check off stage one now. It doesn't work that way. They flow back and forth, and the shock keeps coming back in at different times because it's a process. So there's an overlap and kind of a movement back and forth for a while until you can begin to realize you are moving forward. Does this make sense in your life? Can you see where that fits for you? You want to move out of shock into the second stage?
I had a curiosity how they came up with these.
Well, how they came up with the descriptions?
Yeah, or associated them with the numbers or...
Well, I'll let you have a secret here. Fred and I teach the Enneagram and collaborate on the phone long distance because he lives in Seattle, I live in Denver. And so we have a couple of times gotten together so that we can do more in-depth work. And we were both into our own cycle of grief at one point, where we began doing a lot of intensive sharing. And then we started sharing that with other people who are in all the different different personalities. And we just kind of compiled it following the four stages that we chose to work with. And as we began, you know, working with the four stages, it was like, well, how does a four deal with grief? And so we began looking at that, and knowing what we do about the personality, said, we think this is how it would work. And then we went back to test it with people with all these different personalities. It seems to work. And I, coming from my eight stance, said, yeah, you know, this is what happens to me on, you know, on a regular level in loss. And Fred was able to identify himself there in the seventh. And so then we began just going to the different personalities and say, tell us how it is for you. And this seems to work. Now it helps, you know, it does help if you know fairly well your own personality. And then the more you know about that, the easier it is, I think, in a sense, to identify it. But we tested it out with people we know. And it seems to be accurate.
But it seems like you're at all of these.
Yeah.
We don't do different things. We do them for different reasons. All of this is true for each of us. That's correct. Because we aren't pigeonholed people. You know, we do have all of these characteristics about us, but there's one motivation that's typically ours. There's one gift that's typically ours. And it's, you know, if you at this point would identify yourself having never hit this before, then you are certainly a wonderful human being who is very perceptive. It took most of us very long. And I would not panic at all. You know, if one of them fits and follow that, what I'm really concerned about here is the process of grief and loss. Now, Fred is doing some of the introductory work on the Enneagram, and tapes from his sessions last week are also available if you want to hear those. It's not an easy process to identify what our unconscious motivation is, because it's unconscious. It's unconscious. And so it takes a while for us to pull it into consciousness. You know, why do I do what I do? And there are ways that either one of us could help you, you know, do some identifying there, but then how to move forward and how to be able to use that information is also the key.
What's the key to the lines?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask that. A gram is a drawing. Uh-huh. And as you go through the whole basic workshop, then all of these lines connecting do make sense. But otherwise, I could just as comfortably have removed all these lines and put nine numbers in a circle.
I could I'm trying to see if you go from 1 to 4, or back up to 2 to 8, or whatever.
It was last year.
Yeah. There is a predictable pattern, and there's reason for them.
And she sees the triangle.
She sees the triangle. All right, so see how we look at diagrams differently. Yeah, other people are trying to figure out, now why is this line connected to this line and that line? That's the head part of us asking the questions. And, you know, and it would wish I had the entire day, all 5 days here. We could do all kinds of things. But it's, the lines are, in a sense, directional lines, so that if we would like to grow out of our compulsions, because we all have those, if we would like to grow into a more complete, unified, balanced human being, then the lines are directional signs for us. But we have to stop, we have to start at home territory. We have to have an address first, and then it begins to make sense. I'm sure there's a lot of questions and a lot of puzzlement. And if you could, you know, sort of focus more on the grief work, and then this may or may not ever settle in for this week. But there are books and there is information available. And if you would rather be in Fred's class, feel free. You know, he's doing some more of the basics work. And so that, you know, if you have more questions around that area, you might want to be in those sessions. Did you have a question, Becky?
I'd like to see two.
You'd like to see two, and I'm just aware of right now that Fred didn't give me two, which I love. He brought all the papers he gave me only stage one today. However, this is real fun. This is one of the challenges of working long distance too. Where he said, "Oh, don't bring anything. I've got it all." Well, okay, Fred, just give it to me, would you? He also knew that I'm traveling and have another week of travel, so we will do it a different way. Stage two is the same diagram. Stage two is the denial and the withdrawal. And the denial, I mentioned earlier, yes?
If you'd like, I could run up and make copies of those.
He's got 100 of them up in his condo. Or up in his condo, yeah, how do you like that?
Hey! Yeah, we just set over and go get them.
Freudian slip, huh? Oh, he's got okay. Them, and you know, I'm sorry I didn't remind him that I would need more than this. Anyhow, stage two is the denial and withdrawal. Once I've gone through that first shock and that numbness, and again, it can be real brief, like almost instantaneous at times, other times it's a little longer. Then we go through the denial and the withdrawal. No, this didn't happen. If I distance myself and come back, it'll all be okay. And that can be emotional, mental, relational, physical withdrawal sometimes for some people. If I just go away and come back, it won't have happened. If I do other things and come back physically, emotionally or mentally, then, you know, maybe it didn't happen. In stage two of the denial and withdrawal, here we're dealing with, I am feeling more and I'm feeling less. And I'm going to briefly mention here, I'm going back, I mean, you keep hearing me talk about these same personalities, and there may be a point where it triggers for you, there may not be. In the denial and withdrawal stage, the discerning one, who is always unconsciously making things better, knowing how things could be better, this person frequently in their verbal communications use the terms should and ought. Now, sometimes it'll be nonverbal, like, you know, is that a message? Yes, we've heard that from many times, many ways. And so the inspector one becomes more complaining and less discerning. So they move into the, you know, why can't things be better? Complaining mode. And out of the less discerning of what would be better. Does that make some sense? They become more, not judgmental as much as, you know, things aren't the way they ought to be. the complaining kind of mode. And they lose that ability to discern the better way to be. The two, who is the helper, the assistant two becomes more intrusive. You will let me help you or else, verbally or non-verbally. And they become less helpful because they get in your way. Haven't you had that experience in a loss where people who usually are very helpful are now obnoxious? They're suffering from what I call the OPD, the obnoxious personality disorder. These are the people who are so intrusive. They're usually very helpful. That's their gift. They see what you need and they're there to provide your needs. They become so intrusive because they are in your house now, cleaning your house, reorganizing your kitchen, doing whatever it is because of course you need my help, but in fact they're not being helpful because they're thrusting on you what their own need is. You know people like that? When they could be helpful, then they aren't because they're caught in their own grief. The administrator three, who is usually very organized, has her eye on the goal, knows how to get the job done, becomes more ineffectual. More ineffectual and much less successful. They're the ones who now have their 10-speed bike with the front wheel in the mud, pedaling like crazy, emotionally, mentally, whatever. But the image is there. They become less more ineffectual and less successful when they're caught in their own grief. The four, the author four, feels very special. That's their unconscious motivation, is the need to be special. They become more elitist. More elitist and less human. Less like other people and more aloof, standoffish, more special. Now these are when they're caught in their own grief. So they're less human and more elite is the best term there. Less like everybody else and more different if you want. The Sage Five, who works from their head and has that marvelous gift of analyzing and synthesizing and sharing that information, they become more solitary. They become more alone. They pull farther apart. And they are less known. They do not share themselves with other people. Much more pull apart. We all do a little of all of this. But this is a predictable pattern for different ones. This person is usually gets it analyzed, knows what's happening, figures it out, gives it back in a real rational kind of way, and they isolate themselves. They truly withdraw. They do not want to be like everybody else. The facilitator six, who is usually wonderfully responsive and responsible to a group, they're wonderful group people who are aware of what the group needs. And they too isolate themselves. Where the five withdraws, they isolate from the group. They're usually in a group. But they isolate, so they're more isolated and they become less loyal to the group. The delightful Optimus Seven, who is usually really fun to be around, becomes despondent. More despondent and less delightful. And when you have an Optimus Seven who has lost their optimism in a sense, not much fun to be around. You know somebody like that, I can tell. You want to share a little bit?
Well, my husband died 7 months ago, and you just get all these emotions. He'd been ill for about a year, and we knew he was done, you know, but I don't know, know, you just kind of want to get to be alone and not bother other people how you feel. And I couldn't eat and I couldn't sleep. And
and you identify yourself here, huh?
Yeah, you're seeing some of that. I identify several of these.
Right. But it probably feels as though I'm no fun to be around
right.
anymore, therefore...
She says that all the time.
No, all the time.
Not all the time. She wouldn't be here. But you went through a lot of anticipatory grief then. You went through a bunch of anticipatory grief.
And, you know, you just are real lonely.
Yes, lonely. It's no fun to be around, so I might as well just stay out of the way.
You can be in a big crowd and still very much alone.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. No longer the life of the party.
Well, I never was, but my husband was, but he was more outgoing than I am.
Uh-huh. But it is that feeling that we've all had of, there's no sense in my being with other people because I'm not fun to be around anymore, or right now. And whether we identify that as solitary, isolated, despondent, withdrawn, you hear the terminology, and therefore the stage is called denial and withdrawal. I deny what's happening, and I just withdraw. If I just get away from everybody else, it'll feel better. And somehow it doesn't, for most of us. The champion eight, whose focus usually is the issue of justice and injustice, how to work for the underdog, extreme energy, high energy to work for what they think is important. Usually for others, become more selfish and much less powerful. Unable to work for others and to help others earn, if you want, justice for themselves. So they become much more selfish, focused internally. I'll take care of me, thank you, and let the rest of the world go by. Therefore, they're less powerful in terms of working for others, of helping others. In the ninth position, the negotiator, who is the peaceful, calm, you can say about these people, I always feel comfortable with you. I always feel comfortable. You're always so peaceful and calm. They become more anxious and therefore much less peaceful. They become more anxious within themselves. Yes.
Can you say that all these types in some way become the opposite of the normal type? Mm-hmm. Peaceful becomes more anxious,
that's right.
Entertaining becomes less entertaining.
That's right, because the gift, whatever our gift is, and I'm trying to identify them as I'm moving here, when the gift is pushed to extreme, the helpful too, to extreme, is intrusive, becomes a liability. When I say to you, I'm going to help you whether you want it or not, whether this is the kind of help you want or not, is intrusive, isn't it? It violates the other person's freedom. The champion eight, who is usually justice-oriented by being selfish, is withdrawing their energy that works for other people. So the justice issue here is I'm going to take care of me and not everybody else. See the sense? It's like a misplaced or misused, pushed to extreme kind of thing. So the gift for each of us, pushed to extreme, becomes a liability. And you know, we've always heard, be moderate. Be moderate in all things. This is one of those places where it comes in. If we can balance the gift and liability, and I always say it's kind of like, you know, standing that dime on edge and see how long it stays there. If we can have it there, then we are working in balance. You know how long a dime stands? And somehow it always falls on, quote, the wrong side, like the liability, huh?
But, I mean, these are necessary processes, aren't they? I mean,
they
it's, you know, for the eight,
that's
to
right.
be more, quote, selfish is not a bad thing.
Except that the eight is the most selfish of all the nine. They know how to take care of themselves because they're gut-oriented, which is survival.
But
and
still,
selfish is in that sense.
But it's still, it's still okay to be in that state.
That's right. That's how it is.
Yeah.
Okay or not, that's how it is. That's right. Yeah, and for each of us, it's just the awareness of this is how I cope. And that's what these are. They're coping mechanisms. When I go into shock, it's a coping mechanism. And when I'm denying, it's a coping mechanism. I can't deal with it yet, so I've got to hold it out there. I've got to keep it away from me until I can cope. And so these are, yeah, these are coping styles, if you want.
I have a question about the nine going back. Mm-hmm. You said they get anxious. Mm-hmm. Now, is that an internal thing, or
it can be internal and or external? It's usually on the inside. Sometimes it shows on the outside. The nine can be so peaceful that you almost have to check to see if they're breathing. I mean, that's the possibility and the liability. You know, peaceful goes only so far. At some point, you got to interact. But they become so anxious inside that you may or may not be really aware what's going on. They may also show that anxiety on the outside. And anxiety shows in all kinds of ways, as you know. As you focused in on a particular loss, and are you following a pattern with it? Or have you focused on a loss? One of the things that I suggest with people is that you take a loss that you have endured, as I say, sometimes not an acute loss, or not instantly, you know, not something that's happened to you in the last few months, or maybe even in the last year, but take a loss that's farther back and write yourself through the process. Write yourself through that process. How did you cope? How did you do it? What did you do? Write it out and then see if you can see how you move through these stages. And I might point out to you a resource. One resource is this book that I've picked up. It's the Land of Tears is a Sacred Place. Is a secret place. It's also sacred. The Land of Tears is a Secret Place. And it's a loss/grief support journal workbook. And through this, it gives you some suggestions about how to work through your grief and loss issues. There's a variety of kinds of things. The fun part of this is because it's a workbook, there are blank pages here and there for you to fill in according to your own need. But sometimes that's the kind of thing that is helpful. Either to talk with someone, talk through, this is how I did, this is how I coped, this is what happened, and this is how I got through it. And then to go back and look at other grief experiences you've had. And you know, the hard part is that we're never in one grief process. There are usually several going on at the same time. And so it's like, that's why I say if you can separate out one and just follow it through. Because seldom can we finish a grief process before we can start another one.
Hey, since we're getting close to lunch.
Yes.
And I'm curious, what are the other two stages? Just to have a better sense of the stages of denial that you're using.
Right. The stages that I'm using too. Yeah, the first stage is as we said, the shock and numbness. The second one is denial and withdrawal. The third stage begins to move us forward in life, and that's acknowledgement and pain. The fourth one is acceptance and renewal. These are the stages that we're using.
Are you going to be talking about those at a different session?
Mm-hmm.
Or?
Yeah, tomorrow we'll move on into the next. I did not intend to do the whole thing today. Sorry. There's no way. Even this, it's like pretty fast. And then Friday, what we plan to do is we know the value of ritual. And as we move through the stages of grief, we've become aware of the need to ritualize that. And we ritualize, believe it or not, in nine different ways. And so we'll be talking and hoping that you will share with us some of your experience about, you know, how have you let that go? For some people, they write a letter and live with it for a while and then burn it. For some people, they've told me that they've done something similar. They've written a letter, they've written the story of that loss or why that relationship was important or the job or whatever the loss is. And then they burn it and then they put the ashes out in the ocean and let it wash away. Others have done a drawing in the sand and be with it for a while, let the ocean come and wash that away. There are different ways to ritualize. And ritual is very important for us. So that's what we're looking at for the week. That's a lot of information, I know. And we'll keep adding little bits of information about the Enneagram, as well as how we move forward in that whole process of grief and loss. Questions? I know we're, time is up.
So you mean this class goes on the same time every day this week?
Not the same time. If you've looked at that board, almost nothing goes on the same time every day.
And on time.
We try to stay on time.
But not the same room either?
We'll be in one of these, well, wait a minute, one evening I were over in the Village Center. Just do as we do, and just look at the schedule by the half hour. Yeah, it changes. It just changes according to other kinds of things going on. No, I can't tell you it's every day at this time. Thank you. I hope it helps just a little bit. And Fred and I both are around this week, so if you want to talk further about the Enneagram and or the grief, just catch us.